On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Welcome to On the Bookshelf. This week we've got a special treat. Three different authors who are joining us to talk about their new books. The newest of the interviews was done on February the 15th. It's with Jenny Boyd, who wrote Rock Icons. That'll be followed by Mark Bago with a biography of Joe Cocker that came out around Christmas. And then finally, Jock Grantley of Group Firefall with a new album they have now. So first, here's Jenny Boyd. A new book, Icons of Rock, In Their Own Words from Mango Publishing, is written by Jenny Boyd, ex-wife of Fleetwood Mac drummer Mick Fleetwood and popular session drummer Ian Wallace, former sister-in-law of George Harrison and Eric Clapton. In her young life, she spent around all of these musicians, and she had an opportunity to interview them in 1992 as part of her PhD dissertation on how the world's greatest musicians and producers created. This is her newest version and gone into much more detail on certain particular artists, but also introduced us to some brand new people that weren't in the business, and some of whom weren't even alive when she did her original interviews. So we're really excited to get a chance to talk today to Jenny Boyd. And I want to say that you were a very good interviewer with a very unique relationship to some of your guests.
Well, thank you. Considering most of them were done 35 years ago.
You were married to one of them, or your sister was married to two of them. I mean, this gives you access to people in ways that most interviewees never, ever have. And I was fascinated to learn that, did I read this right, you had 75 cassettes of these interviews that you carted around with you for years to keep them safe?
Yes, that's true. The sad bit is, because I carted these around with me for 35 years, big audio tapes, and I felt so protective of them. But in the end, because I was going from traveling from place to place and I couldn't ask anybody to put them all into MP3, you know, it was too many. In the end, I destroyed them about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, except for 8, which is George Harrison, Eric Clapton, Don Henley, Ringo, Graham Nash, Ravi Shankar, Tony Williams, and Joni Mitchell. So that's why in this book, we have the complete interview of those 5 people. And then what I've done is taken it out of the original book from 92 that was under chapters of peak experience or drugs and alcohol, and put them all together. So you have Keith Richards, and all the bits from the book have been put together. So you just look up Keith and then you see that. You don't have the complete interview, but you have a big chunk of it.
Oh, okay. Are you pleased with the way the book turned out?
I really am. And then we got these 4 new people that I did last year, mm-hmm. just to give the reader and me an idea of how different the music world is today compared to then, when I did the interviews between 1988 and 1990.
Right. There were some particular phrases that certain guests said in the interviews that I thought were really very cool. My favorite one is Don Henley, who said, "Songs just keep us company. That's all." I love that. And isn't
love
it the truth?
That's true. There were so many things, you know, as I was transcribing them all again, just, you know, last year when I was doing the book. Mm-hmm. Just, it still fills me with awe, you know. Just, Joni Mitchell, what she says, and just, it's timeless. It's beautiful. And it's, you know, it was such a different world then.
I was really struck by so many of the artists who were talking about transcendence. Eric Clapton in particular said music is transcendent, and went on at some length about it. But many of them had the same kind of vibe going on, that creating music became a sort of an otherworldly sort of event, a creative high, or a kind of a special space that they entered into.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is what, when I ask them, you know, have you ever had the peak experience, which is psychologist Abraham Maslow in the 50s, I think, described what that is. And it's exactly what people call nowadays, they call it being in the zone, mm-hmm. you know, where things just come through you. And you know, you can be on stage and I think Graham Nash said this, you all sing the wrong verse at the same time because you become so connected in this high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or if you're writing songs, words just come from nowhere. And you look at the song and you think, gosh, did I write that? You know, there is a real kind of sense of being like a channel, and they all talk about that.
Huey Lewis said songwriters have to get away from society so they can reflect on society. That's pretty profound, and I like the implications of that. That's that duality of being a musician, isn't it? That you have to be part of humanity, but you also have to be able to step away so you can look at humanity and say, this is what I think of what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. And also there's a sense of, they're like the forerunners of what's going on in our generation. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like the torchbearers. And they speak for the masses in many ways.
Were you surprised at how many of them, of the people that you talked to, it seemed like there were quite a few of them, a couple stuck out in particular, that had family members who were musicians. They weren't necessarily professionals, although in some cases they were, but many of them had family members that were musicians, but not necessarily in the kind of music that they ended up doing. Like Stevie Nicks' grandfather sang country and western, and Michael McDonald's dad was an Irish tenor. I found that really interesting how they were influenced by the music, even if they didn't embrace the same style, say.
Well, exactly. And Christine McVie's dad plays the violin.
Yes.
And, but also another thing is that those musicians who had families that were musical, or parents, say, or families, they were the ones that got more in touch earlier in their lives than the musicians who actually had somebody else outside the home who taught them, to do their music,
yeah,
or at least encourage them with their music.
And that is not really a surprise. If you grow up in a home with music, it's just part of what you do and part of the air you breathe. I would think it makes it a lot easier to do that yourself. I grew up in a family of musicians, and we're all amateur musicians, but we all raise children who are musicians too.
Yeah. And how wonderful.
Yeah.
And how amazing that must be, I've often thought, to be playing with your family, to be playing an instrument. I mean, that's a connection.
Yes. Oh, indeed. And it is a great deal of fun. Most of the time when I get together with my brothers, it's in opportunities for us to, we don't live in the same states, but we get together and we play together and make music together. And it's like, even though we haven't seen each other physically for a year or two, when we play together, it's like no time has passed between it at all.
Well, that's lovely. It's just another language,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it truly is.
Yeah.
The interviews with Ringo and Graham Nash and David Crosby, now I understand why they were much longer, but I will say also that I was really struck by, these are people that seem to always have such a cheery outlook and kind of lighthearted, but when you talked to them, you got them to open up, and they were really deep people too, and that was a lovely thing to read about.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, what was a surprise to me, because originally, I was very shy, and I was, mixed wise, and I'd go on the road, and I didn't really talk to people because I was too shy, and, all this kind of stuff when I was younger. And but then, when I started drinking, then I kind of felt a little braver and sort of chat a bit more, and everybody was drinking, and then it got to the time when everybody was taking cocaine and all this sort of stuff. And so as I thought of musicians, was more that kind of way of thinking. So when I started interviewing them, suddenly I realized, the depth that was there that I didn't know about.
Right.
And that was so surprising to me. I mean, say George, it was okay because, I knew him, and he was just like a lovely older brother. But it was wonderful for me to open up these musicians that I had seen on one particular level, but also been totally inspired by their music and their songwriting.
I was struck by the fact that all of the Beatles had significant losses among their parents. I knew about Paul and John, but I was struck by learning about Ringo and George losses that they had, and how all of these guys got together and made such magnificent music and overcame these difficult early times. And I know, is there anything else that you wanted to say that I didn't ask you?
Oh, so much.
Yes, we
very nice to talk.
Well, we could have easily talked a couple of hours because the book is just full of great stuff. But thank you, Jenny. I appreciate you making time to talk to me today for the guys at Premier giving us a little extra time to get to visit. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you.
We've been talking to Jenny Boyd, a 1960s fashion model ex-wife of Mick Fleetwood and session drummer Ian Wallace and former sister-in-law of George Harrison and Eric Clapton. Her newest book, Icons of Rock in Their Own Words, published in the United States by Mango Publishing. Up next, Mark Bago and a fascinating biography of the legendary singer Joe Cocker. Well, today we have a chance to learn a little bit about one of the most iconic characters in rock and roll, a guy who loved the blues so much that Ray Charles considered his influence on Joe Cocker to be a real tribute and was pleased that Joe Cocker was such a huge fan of his that he would want to sing in a very similar style. But for most people who were cited, what really made Joe Cocker unique were his onstage mannerisms as he sang. Here to talk about this iconic artist, Joe Cocker, we have Mark Bago. His new book is With a Lot of Help from His Friends, and it's available online and in bookstores everywhere. Most of us don't know very much about Joe Cocker, except for the fact that he kind of burst on the scene. He had been building his career quietly in garage bands and so forth for years, right?
He grew up in Sheffield, England, had a band that literally did rehearse in his parents' garage, and played, you know, clubs and what have you. And in fact, one of the scenes in my book is him at a Battle of the Bands with the Rolling Stones. And he ends up with the best reviews in the newspaper the next day. So, you know, I think that whole scenario is just so brilliant of what a hotbed of music it must have been back then. Mm-hmm. What happened was 1963, 1964 came around. The Beatles became everything, and every record label wanted a band like the Beatles. And so it was a ripe time for Joe to launch his band and his musical career.
Now, interestingly enough, he has some success, and then he gets tired of it and doesn't do much for about a year. This is kind of a pattern that goes through most of his life, doesn't it? That he'll be excited about a project, and he'll get into it, and he'll work his very hardest, but then when he's ready for it to be over, that's it.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, almost, you know, career suicide. Here in 1969, August of 1969, he performs at Woodstock, blows everybody away who's there, the 500,000 people who are there, just amazed by it. The Woodstock album comes out, the Woodstock documentary comes out, Joe is like suddenly this big star, the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour happens, Leon Russell puts together this whole rock and roll circus of a tour for Joe, that's a big success, the album comes out, the documentary comes out, where's Joe? Joe's on his parents' sofa drunk for 2 years, depressed. Like, here he, you know, this kind of stardom, most, you know, singers or performers would be like, oh my God, let's put together another tour. You know, we got to make hay while the sun shines here. Joe instead, well, I don't feel like it. I'm depressed. So then when he does his big comeback, no one cares. Time has moved on. The music scene has changed.
Right.
And it wasn't until he bumbles into the song, You Are So Beautiful, that he's back on the charts again and happening. But, you know, it's so funny to read a book or to write a book about someone who is so talented, so driven, and yet so depressed about
yeah.
it. I mean, he had so much yeah. to celebrate.
The fascinating thing to me is that, like most people, I didn't really understand why he sang the way he did. That is to say, with the hand gestures that just seemed like he was kind of losing his mind or something.
I remember Absolutely.
I watched Saturday Night Live from the very inception, and I remember when John Belushi came out and did a spot-on impersonation of Joe Cocker Joe Cocker is singing on the show. And it was extraordinary. And you addressed this little portion of Joe's life in the book, and I thought, oh gosh, he's going to be furious because he's making fun of his kind of spastic movements and everything. But according to your book, that isn't the way he felt about it at all.
No, Joe was actually flattered by it. His friends would go, look at this video of so you're going to get so pissed off. He goes, oh my God, this guy's great. Because Belushi had done an imitation of Joe on on a Lemmings movie or like a TV special.
Right.
And so he kind of had been practicing the whole Joe Cocker spastic choreography. And, you know, everyone, I hope, goes to YouTube and looks at this little clip, because the look on Joe's face, once John Belushi starts imitating him, like, you know, like a mirror image behind him, drunken and crazy and everything, the look on Joe's face is like, what the hell is this? Yet it's a classic moment, and he was actually flattered by the whole thing.
Yeah, he said that he'd been having some throat problems. No big surprise, considering he was a two-pack-a-day smoker minimum, plus a lot of alcohol. Belushi took him to his own voice doctor and everything, and was very meek and humble around him. And I thought, well, isn't that lovely? That's a wonderful reflection on both of these people that most people only know from their public persona.
Exactly. And as you said, you would think they would be worst enemies. They ended up best friends. It's just kind of crazy how things come about. And Joe, talk about worst enemy. I mean, he had a show at the Roxy in L.A. that was going to be his big comeback. He had the song You Are So Beautiful. It was on the charts. Everyone was happy with him. He gets on stage at the Roxy. Well, they didn't know before the curtain went up. Some friend of his showed up with a bunch of cocaine and booze. Joe gets through one song. Jimmy Webb is on stage starting The Moon's a Harsh Mistress, which Joe had just recorded. Joe completely lost it and completely just collapsed like a Raggedy Andy doll right on stage. They put the curtain down, and that was the end. He just completely screwing up his career right and left. And the next thing you know, he gets a chance to sing with Jennifer Warnes on Up Where We Belong, the biggest song of his entire career. I mean, it's amazing how he had all these second chances in his career right up to the very end.
It's amazing because, for example, you were talking about the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour, and I remember the album when it came out, and thinking, good grief, look at the people that are on this album. All these people that later became big stars in their own right really got their start, or at least their public awareness during that tour. Rita Coolidge, no one outside of the music business had ever heard of Leon Russell until then. He becomes a major thing. And
exactly.
And once again, the same thing happens, that at first, Joe Cocker says, oh, this is great. This guy's doing all this work. He's making me look good. I'll give him a chance to have some solo stuff in this enormous concert. But something changes, and after a while, he decides that maybe Leon Russell is just out for himself and using him, and he turns against him.
It's really a sad story in a way. I was very honored by the fact that I was flown to Tulsa a couple weeks ago to launch this book, to go to Leon Russell's recording studio, The Church, which has been restored and is like a museum to Leon Russell. Anyone who goes to Tulsa should go to The Church and see this. But there's a display of all the Mad Dogs and Englishmen memorabilia, and Leon loved Joe Cocker. And I think it was people, I was told that it was people on the tour going, you know, Joe, he's stealing all your thunder, blah, 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 blah. No, he was setting up Joe to be an even bigger star and, you know, taking some of the weight off of Joe so Joe could just be the star.
Yeah.
And it's so unfortunate that they couldn't have gone on together as friends. Now, another redemption thing that happened in Joe's life is towards the end of his career, he and Leon played a show in Tulsa and eventually kind of buried the hatchet a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's some amazing music they could have made together.
Yeah. Late in life, middle age, Joe Cocker falls in love, gets married, eventually starts to realize that the booze and the cigarettes are bad for him, and eventually gives them both up, but the damage is done. He dies at a relatively young age, although not for a rock and roller who is as sincere about his partying as he was. But what an incredible talent. What a very unique individual. And you do a really wonderful job in giving us all these different facets of his life. That I remember hearing about Cocker having the hymn CD that he came out with later toward the end of his life. Read some things here and there that said he had kind of a religious revival and everything. And I thought, isn't this amazing? This guy would be completely turned in a completely different direction by the time that he died.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And you know, the credit really goes to his wife, Pam Baker, who one day gave a dinner party. They were hosting a bunch of their friends at their place in Colorado. Joe comes down to the table just completely drunk out of his mind. Pam marches him upstairs and says, look, it's either the booze or me. You make a choice. Beasts, and he absolutely stopped cold turkey. And the last 10 years of his life, his happiness at home in Colorado was growing tomatoes and walking with his dog out in the hills. And the tomato growing is something he inherited from his dad. His dad always had prize tomatoes.
Right.
So it was kind of, you know, interesting that Joe ends up, you know, reflecting where his roots are from and growing tomatoes in Colorado.
Amazing, amazing. We've been talking to Mark Bago. His new book is Joe Cocker with a lot of help from his friends. Introduction by Woodstock legend Melanie, which is fun.
I love Melanie.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I know that you've probably got another interview behind me, and you've been doing them all morning, but I'm really glad I got a chance to talk to you. It's really a terrific book, and I read a lot of books, so it's really great to get to enjoy one as much as I did this one.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and it's great talking to you as well.
All right. You take care, Mark, and next book, let's do this again.
Okay. I love it. You're on.
Okay. We've been talking to Mark Bago, the author of 68 published books on rock and roll and show business. He's been referred to by the Publishers Weekly as the Prince of Pop Music Bios, has had multiple New York Times bestsellers, and continues to examine the lives of the biggest rock stars in the business, a list which includes Elton John, and his newest on Joe Cocker with a lot of help from his friend. Next, Jock Grantley of Firefall. In the mid-1970s, there was a brand new band. It was made up of people that had played together in various combinations, and they brought a completely unique sound to the group Firefall. Their big hits were You Are the Woman, Just Remember I Love You, and Strange Way. But they were more than just their hits. They were an entirely different way of enjoying and making music. We're thrilled to have Jock Bartley, who was the guitarist for Firefall and co-founder. They've gotten the band back together, and they're taking it on the road. There's a new album out called Friends and Family that's available now. And they hit the road starting September 30th, going all around the country, and they will wrap up their tour in the early part of February. The closest they'll get to us will be in Florida, probably in early December, so be watching for those dates. And we're delighted to welcome Jock Bartley to visit with us today.
Hey, Dave, how's it going?
It's going really well. I am so excited to get a chance to talk to you. First of all, I got to tell you, I've been in radio since the early 70s, so I got to play all of your hits with Firefall when they were brand new records.
You know, it was so great back in those days, and Firefall, when we formed, we had 30 original songs to choose from by our singer-songwriters Rick Roberts and Larry Burnett, and it's always been about the songs. And yeah, I'm a good guitar player, Michael Clark was a great drummer, or Mark Andes, but it's the songs, and we had a bunch of good ones to start with.
You really did, and such variety. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I heard You Are the Woman, and I thought, that's a flute going on there, and pretty kicking. Discovering that you have a background in jazz as a very young guitarist, I'm thinking right. That might have had something to do with it.
Yeah, I had roots with a world-famous jazz guitar teacher, Johnny Smith, who made records and played with Bing Crosby and Stan Getz and all these people. But I'll tell you what, when February 9th, 1964 happened and the Beatles played on Ed Sullivan, that changed everything in my life and a lot of young kids' lives around America. And I wanted to play rock and roll, and I already played guitar for about 5 years. So, you know, I had a really good upbringing. I was just waiting to meet a person like Rick Roberts who had a bag full of songs that were great that I could play on. And, you know, Firefall's been a tasty band that played a wide variety of music, but it's always been about the songs.
That's one of the things that I love about your career. You have played with some incredible musicians. You have played in groups with wonderful players. You've been contemporary with some of the great musicians of the soundtrack of my life. Was there ever a time that you guys were working on a song and everybody else said, no, it's too much of this or it's too much of that? Or were you able to work collaboratively most of the time?
Well, in the old days, Rick or Larry would bring us a song. And when we heard, for instance, Cinderella for the first time, you know, we knew and we had great producers, including at times Tom Dowd or Ron and Howard Albert, you know, down in Miami and stuff. And everything that a guitar player like me or a drummer or a bass player needs to enhance the song. And I've always considered myself a pretty tasty player and never kind of overdid it. And it's not an ego trip about, oh, I get to play licks on this song. It's about furthering how great the song could be.
Right.
It's really been great. But this Friends and Family album, you know, we had to pick the songs very carefully because some songs like Up on Cripple Creek by the band or Barracuda by heart were, in my mind, off limits. No. You shouldn't touch those.
But right.
We had our choice of songs to play and recorded them with great love and respect for the original versions, the bands that recorded those, and also the 60s and 70s music, which, time like that, I don't think will ever happen again.
Yeah, I agree that there was such an encouragement for people growing up. I'm just a little younger than you are, but I played in garage bands, trumpet player, so we had to do different kind of stuff. But when Blood, Sweat, and Tears came along, man, every trumpet player in America said, "I'm going to play in a band like this, and this is what I can do."
Exactly.
It just so
course,
so rich.
It was Blood, Sweat, and Tears in Chicago. It's like with the horn
right.
section. Oh boy!
Right. There were so many opportunities. The listeners seemed to be more open to what's out there. You know, is there a new sound? Is there something that's a little different? And it wasn't so rigidly confined to categories, it seemed. So
that's why one of the main reasons that I think the music of the 70s will never be duplicated, because record labels kept their hands off. If you had good songs and were going to make an album, they didn't really tell you what to do or how to sound. They took your record and they put it out, and it's either successful or not. But about the 80s, man, the record labels decided to say, oh no, we have to do this, you need to sound more like this.
Mm-hmm.
And the control, you know, and back in the late 60s and 70s, bands got to be who they were.
Yeah.
And that was great.
Yeah. Well, when I saw the set list, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a terrific album. And the fact that you guys are doing a tour together, this is so fun. This is so the stuff that we grew up doing. You guys start on the 30th, and you'll be on the road in one place or another all the way into February. Who all is touring with you?
All the original guys, and in fact, like Michael Clark died many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We have a really kicking band with great vocalists now. John Bisaha and Steve Weinmeister are the guys who sang all over this record. Yeah, I'm the third singer, and I sing a little bit on this, but having guys singing that good. But it was amazing, because we play on the road with everybody from REO Speedwagon in America to Orleans and Atlanta Rhythm Section and Pure Prairie League. So
wow.
We get to share the stage a lot of nights on tour with bands like that, and it's just so great. To tour with Atlanta Rhythm Section or Pure Prairie League, who we met back in the 70s and played with. So how lucky I am to still be doing this.
I think that's one of the great things about being a musician, and I'm just an amateur musician, but I still get to play, and I make it a point to be around young musicians, college musicians, and
right.
I tell them, you know, when you were a kid in the band and everybody said, oh, why aren't you a football player or something, and you were smart and you stayed in the band, I said, let me tell you something. I've been to high school reunions, and those football heroes are all walking around on artificial knees and stuff, and they're not playing football anymore. I'm 70 years old, and I'm still traveling internationally with big bands. I said, you can do the
right.
same thing.
Yeah, music is the international language, you know. Hey, Dave, I got a scoop for you.
Okay.
We're 5 or 6 songs into Friends and Family 2.
Oh.
Expanding this idea and playing, you know, we didn't play a Stephen Stills song on the first record, or Kenny Loggins. We did Loggins and Messina, but not
right.
Kenny Loggins. So we have a whole new Friends and Family 2 album coming out in the spring, probably of 2024, because it's such a great idea for us, a band like we are, to honor and record other great songs from that era. I just know how fortunate I am to still be doing this.
That is exciting. I got to be honest, seeing a Dan Fogelberg song, say, on new album that's out now, it's available now, that just thrills my heart, because it just made me so sad when he died, and I thought, is anyone ever going to play his music again except oldie stations? And now you're bringing his...
You know, a difficult song to pick, because, you know, which Dan Fogelberg song do you do, or just which
right.
song you do?
Yeah.
You know, and on the Fogelberg song, I kept it as producer really down the center of the road, and I even copied his guitar solo because it was so great. Dan was an amazing singer, songwriter, guitar player that I was fortunate enough to get to know and play on stage with some.
Great.
Hey, thanks. Very nice talking to you, Dave.
And you too, Jock. Thanks for the great music, man. Our guest today, Jock Bartley, the guitarist of Firefall and the co-founder. He's put the band back together. They're taking it on the road with the Friends and Family album that's just been released, and they'll be on tour starting September the 30th in Missouri. For Jock, it's always been about the song.
We hope you enjoyed our three guests today, Jenny Boyd, Mark Vago, and Jock Grantley of Firefall. We'll see you next week on The Bookshelf, on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and on WTBF Radio. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.